and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with yesterday's extraordinary remark by President Trump, which is reminiscent of his Helsinki press conference when he displayed his fealty to Putin over his loyalty to the United States, and that is Trump's siding with North Korea's dictator Kim Jong-un over his own CIA by saying he wouldn't let our intelligence services spy on Kim's murderous and secretive regime. Jung Park, a senior fellow and the South Korea Foundation chair in Korean studies at the Brookings Institution Center for East Asia Policy Studies, joins us to discuss the extraordinary lengths Trump is prepared to go to forgive or at least ignore Kim's ruthless rule and outrageous violations of international law. After all, the issue at hand Trump is responding to is the revelation that Kim's half-brother, who was murdered by VX Nerve agent in Kuala Lumpur's international airport, was a source for the CIA. But the use of a weapon of mass destruction at a civilian airport apparently does not bother Trump. Nor, for that matter, does murdering family members or countless numbers of North Korean citizens. We'll try to assess why Trump gushed over the latest, quote, beautiful letter he got from Kim, and why there is an apparent desperation on Trump's part to make a deal with the North Korean dictator, which goes against Trump's own advice in The Art of the Deal, to not look too hungry for a deal. Never before has the United States had a leader who is so demonstrably loyal to foreign adversaries, prompting former National Security Advisor Susan Rice to tweet, quote, America, this tells you all you need to know about our so-called commander-in-chief. Then Ryan Grimm, the D.C. bureau chief for The Intercept, joins us in the studio. The former Washington bureau chief for The Huffington Post, where he led a team that was twice a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, winning once. His latest book is We've Got People, From Jesse Jackson to AOC, The End of Big Money and the Rise of a Movement. We'll discuss the energy of the insurgent left of the Democratic Party versus the cautious institutionalism of its establishment wing, represented by the frontrunner in the crowded field of presidential candidates, Joe Biden. With revelations in his book showing how the institutionalist Senator Feinstein stymied the opportunity to prevent Brett Kavanaugh being confirmed to the Supreme Court, We've Got People serves as a wake-up call to the grassroots to get active while the Democratic Party plays it safe. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Jung Park, who is a senior fellow and the South Korea Foundation Chair in Korean Studies at Brookings Institution Center for East Asia Policy Studies. She focuses on the national security challenges facing the United States and East Asia, including North Korea's weapons of mass destruction capabilities, the regime's domestic and foreign policy calculus, internal stability, and inter-Korean ties. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jung Park.
Thank you.
And the president made an extraordinary remark yesterday when it was revealed that a CIA operative had met with Kim Jong-un's half-brother, who was murdered by a binary form of nerve gas, a weapon of mass destruction, at the airport in Malaysia some time back. And in response to those revelations in the press, the president basically said that under his watch, he wouldn't have let the CIA recruit Kim Jong-un's half-brother, and in essentially saying that he doesn't think that the CIA should be doing its job, which I assume is necessary in a very secretive regime like North Korea to gather information about what's going on.
Yeah, you know, the CIA's mission, one of its key missions is to support and is to collect and analyze intelligence that would be used or useful for the president and for other policymakers to advance key national security priorities. And so in President Trump's comments recently, it's not the first time that he said something about the intelligence community or CIA in particular. If you recall, a few months ago, during the annual threat assessment testimony by the Director of National Intelligence, the president called the senior intelligence officers or leaders to task for saying that North Korea still remains a threat, even though the president was trying to craft this narrative of advancing negotiations with North Korea, and that the North Korea conversations and its relationship with Kim should be cast in a more positive light. So this is not the first time that the president has criticized the intelligence community, and I expect that it won't be the last. But I think what's important is for you and your readers to understand is that this is what the CIA does, and that is in service of the president and of our national security objectives.
But have we ever had a situation where we have a president who doesn't appear to be either interested in the CIA's job or want to partake of their services?
One of the reasons that intelligence matters, intelligence meaning in terms of intelligence collection and gathering, is that everything that we do in the intelligence community is in support of the policy. We don't make policy. And yes, this is the first time. Well, this president is the first president to criticize, I think, in my recent memory, in this particular kind of way. But I think North Korea is a really hard target. We used to call it and we still do, the hardest of the hard targets. And we try to get as much information as we can to make sure that our decision makers have the best information. And for the president, I think it's important for him to understand that diplomacy requires good intelligence as well.
And again, I'm speaking with Jong Pak, who is a senior fellow and the South Korea Foundation Chair in Korean Studies at the Brookings Institution Center for East Asia Policy Studies. She focuses on the national security challenges facing the United States and East Asia, including North Korea's weapons of mass destruction capabilities, the regime's domestic and foreign policy calculus, internal stability, and inter-Korean ties. But just back to the means by which the half-brother of Kim Jong-un, Kim Jong-nam, was assassinated at the airport in Malaysia, the main airport, by a couple of young women who I think thought they were involved in some kind of reality TV stunt. And what was used was a binary form of nerve gas, VX, an incredibly lethal weapon of mass destruction. One woman applied one of the chemicals and the second one the second, and this was such a provocative act. You don't normally use weapons of mass destruction to assassinate people. So there had to be some purpose or some message behind doing that. And it seems to me that was crossing a major line. No matter whether you're from North Korea or whatever regime, it just struck me at the time of being so extraordinary. And I don't think that our president seems to put this in that kind of context.
Right. And if you absolutely the Kim regime was trying to send a message. Think about where it was done at an international airport where there are, you know, thousands of or countless numbers of cameras watching every move. And, you know, there is a very reality TV kind of feel to what was happening with these women coming in, rubbing the chemicals or the nerve agent on Kim Jong-nam's face, the half-brother's face, the way the half-brother stumbled to get help, how he was shown, you know, weak and unable to control himself on the very cameras. And one of the things that North Korea does well is that it keeps pushing the boundaries of what's acceptable. This could have been a major disaster at an international airport. These are highly these are very deadly chemicals that the two women used, and so it could have affected an innocent bystander if they were less careful, or this could have been sheer luck as well. And so North Korea pushes boundaries. And to date, Kim Jong-un has not face any blowback from this activity. And in fact, the two women were just released by Malaysia. And so no one is responsible, apparently, except for, but we know that Kim Jong-un is responsible given the fact that he almost certainly had to give the order to assassinate his half-brother.
But in terms of the CIA's job, which is to find information about this incredibly hermetically sealed, secretive regime, it seems like you couldn't have had a better source, right, than the half-brother. He certainly would know about the command structure and also the leader, since he's his half-brother.
I'm not going to go into that, but I would say that it's really hard to get information about North Korea, but there have been great strides made through open source. We get there's a lot of information out there from defectors. But one of the things that I encourage your viewers to understand and recognize is that all of this information doesn't mean anything unless it's analyzed. And the Kim regime has done it, Kim Jong-un and also his father before him have done their best to stovepipe the bureaucracies, have an information blockade. They keep their elite and their North Korean populace in fear, and they've created a surveillance state where you just do not want to be even thinking about anything again or criticisms about the regime for fear of getting sent to a prison camp along with your family. So that makes that's one of the reasons that North Korea is so difficult to target, because of the repressive systems and the regime's efforts to make sure that information doesn't get in and information doesn't get out. And I would say generally that it's one of the most difficult things for intelligence analysts to do is to get at leadership intentions, because you can't literally get into the mind of a leader. And so I think there's been a lot of good analysis done on how Kim Jong-un ticks, what are his priorities, what are his preferences, but these are all educated assessments rather than anything definitive. And so I think that's why diplomacy is important as well, to try to get at some of the regime intentions as well as their capabilities.
Well, I recently spoke with a colleague of yours, Sumi Terry, at the time that the South Korean major newspaper was reporting that the person who arranged the Hanoi summit that failed to come up with a deal and was apparently quite humiliation for Kim Jong-un, that he had basically, you know, they had to kill the messenger in a sense. Somebody had to be the fall guy for the failure. But it turned out that he's not really dead. So it's obviously there are some problems, are there not, with intelligence collection, even from the South Koreans, who one assumes are in a better position to figure out what's going on next door.
You're asking what? I'm just saying that
the fact that one of the sources for information, a major South Korean newspaper, which apparently has good sources inside the North,
right. Uh-huh.
They got that wrong, did they not?
Well, you know, this South Korean press reports on a lot of things, and I thought that report was pretty thinly sourced. It was, I think it came from just one source. And so that points to, you're right, Ian, that it is difficult. That's why, you know, we have to process and use other information to figure out what's going on. So it's not surprising to me that that Kim was frustrated that, you know, he did spend 60 plus hours on a train to get to Hanoi. The regime media had reported on the second summit. And so Kim probably lost some face, given that he was not able to manipulate the bilateral summit to try to loosen the sanctions or to get the sanctions removed. So it's not surprising to me that the regime would punish or point the fingers at the negotiators. But I think that judging from what Kim has been saying and the regime's actions, they do want to get back and talk to President Trump. Meanwhile, they're criticizing the other administration officials like Secretary of State Pompeo and the National Security Advisor, John Bolton, calling them gangster-like for demanding that North Korea denuclearize.
Well, during the Cold War, of course, there was a cottage industry of trying to read the Kremlin's tea leaves, and it would seem even more difficult reading the tea leaves in North Korea. But to my mind, it's also incredibly difficult to figure out what's going on with our own administration, with our leadership here, because when the president, when he made that extraordinary remark about saying that essentially on his, well, I'll quote exactly what he says, "I don't know this, that the relationship with Kim is such that that wouldn't happen under my auspices." That's what he said in relationship to revelations that the half-brother had been a CIA source. But then he went on to say that he'd received a beautiful letter from Kim and that Kim had kept his word on suspending nuclear and missile testing, which is not true. And when Trump was in Japan, which is quite close to North Korea, he more or less said, well, it's no big deal, and they didn't violate UN sanctions, which I think left the Japanese feeling a little uncomfortable because almost the president was almost saying, well, if the missile could reach the United States, we have a problem. But the missiles that were tested could certainly reach Japan. So what is going on with our leadership? Why, if our president seems to desperately need this deal so much, that's not very reassuring. You know, this is the man that supposedly wrote the art of the deal, and you don't go into a deal, surely, when you're just, you know, begging for any deal.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that North Korea is a hard target, but I think because given some of the signs of policy dysfunction and the president's unpredictable style, that it's hard to even predict our own government's policies. The way I read the president's statements about the May 2019 ballistic missile test that Kim Jong-un did, they are violations of UN's sanctions. And the acting Secretary of Defense, Shanahan, said that there were violations, as did the National Security Advisor. So these are technically violations of those sanctions, but President Trump's statements are probably intended to keep the momentum of dialogue and to show Kim that Trump is a reliable interlocutor to try to get a deal. But I think the message that sends is really problematic because, one, you want to, the U.S. must be able to assure our allies, Japan and South Korea, who are under the greatest threat from North Korea's ballistic missiles, that the U.S. will be there and that U.S. is, and that the U.S. is committed to their defense. And two, I think it sends a bad message to Kim that as long as he doesn't do intercontinental ballistic missile testing, that he can do everything else because that's really what the U.S. cares about. I think that's the wrong message. I think it erodes a lot of U.S. credibility in the region, and it also probably reinforces for Kim that President Trump is on his side. And so when you hear that as a young 34, 35-year-old dictator in North Korea with nuclear weapons, are you going to be willing to give that up if the president apparently seems to be on your side?
Well, just in closing, Jong Park, it does seem, though, that we are certainly in a better situation with Trump's efforts, particularly when he started out calling him Rocket Man in front of the United Nations and deriding him. And we know that he's very sensitive. After all, he had his hackers hack into Sony to try and stop a movie about him getting global distribution. So he's obviously very sensitive. But Fire and Fury was pretty scary. And I think a lot of the allies were quite scared by that. So to the extent that he's having these love letters and talking about these beautiful letters and almost talking about a romance here with Kim Jong-un, I suppose on the surface that is an improvement. But again, I get back to the mystery about what it is that our president really wants from this person who is probably the world's worst dictator. He's probably killed more of his own people, certainly on a per capita basis, than most dictators probably, what, since Mao Zedong? It's hard to know.
I would hope that this is not the case. You know, North Korea represents, as you've mentioned before, North Korea represents not just a nuclear and ballistic missile threat, but it's also a cyber threat. It also possesses one of the largest stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons, not to mention the fact that it has a 1 million man and woman plus army that is forward deployed, ready to hit South Korea at any given notice. So I think, you know, we have to understand the totality of the North Korea threat, and that we have to address all of those threats. And just talking about these love letters doesn't mean that they don't have those capabilities anymore. And in denying that North Korea tested some ballistic missiles last month doesn't mean that they don't have them anymore. So what I worry about is that we begin to have this binary perception or conception of, well, at least we're not at fire and fury, so everything is okay. The threat is there, and I don't think that the threat has been reduced. We just happen to be in a temporary lull in terms of North Korean provocative actions.
Well, Jong Pak, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jong Pak, who's a senior fellow and the South Korean Foundation Chair of Korean Studies at the Brookings Institution Center for East Asia Policy Studies. She focuses on the national security challenges facing the United States and East Asia, including North Korea's weapons of mass destruction capabilities, the regime's domestic and foreign policy calculus, internal stability, and inter-Korean ties. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back joined in the studio by the D.C. Bureau Chief for The Intercept, Ryan Grimm.
I'm more important in the USA than a spy for the FBI. I'm trained to meet the criminal elite, and I seek out wherever evil resides. I spy. I'm at home in the streets of Rome.
We want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now in the studio is Ryan Grimm, the D.C. Bureau Chief for The Intercept. He was previously the Washington Bureau Chief for The Huffington Post, where he led a team that was twice a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, winning once. And his latest book just out is We've Got People, From Jesse Jackson to AOC, The End of Big Money and the Rise of a Movement. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ryan Grimm.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you, Ryan. And from your lips to God's ears, in terms of the title of your book, obviously we have a condition now where our representatives are essentially telemarketers who spend their days dialing for dollars. And it is really refreshing, and I think you have to give Bernie Sanders the credit for creating this idea that you can match big money, dark money for these 501c4 vehicles, that unlimited amounts of money can come from plutocrats without any attribution. But the fact that we've got 23-something candidates running, isn't that splitting the pie a little bit, even before you get off the ground, in terms of the kind of grassroots money?
Sure. And, you know, the DNC has finally leaned into this idea that small donors are a central part of how campaigns can be funded and what makes a campaign strong. And so this year they famously said, if you get 65,000 donors, then you'll be on the debate stage, as long as you've also met a few other requirements, like 1%, I think, in three polls. And interestingly, a number of serious candidates are struggling to meet that. You know, Kirsten Gillibrand spent several years building up a small dollar army, and she has been unable to translate those into supporters of her presidential campaign. And so, you know, she's really struggling. And you have consultants out there who are now charging, you know, $40, $50, $60 per $1 donation. So in other words, if you go to a consultant and they say, well, you know, we'll get you 1,000 people to give you a dollar each on Facebook or some other avenue, but mostly it's Facebook, but that'll cost you between $30 and $75 each. which shows how hard they're working to just find these remaining few small donors.
Right, to get to the threshold, to get
right
into the debate. And Cory Booker is now putting out appeal for a dollar mm-hmm donation.
Everybody wants that dollar.
Yeah.
Give me that dollar.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So
I would give someone a dollar just for $20 even. A bargain.
Well, tell me this, and I'm almost begging you to give me a good answer here. The Democratic base, many of them, are very upset that Hillary Clinton lost to this unbelievable disaster, Trump.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, how could you be beaten by him? If the Democrats lose in 2020, I think it'll be the end of the Democratic Party. I think the rank and file will just basically desert them, saying, Tom Perez, you guys, what in God's name? Why do we need you?
Yeah.
So there's an awful lot at stake, to my mind. It's not just the fact that we have so many candidates and it's hard to get a sense that anybody can step up, you know. And there was a recent CNN poll that said something like a majority of Americans think that Trump's going to get reelected. So tell me it's not true.
Well, let's see what types of excuses they would have to come up with, you know, if they managed to lose a second time to Donald Trump. Let's say that they succeeded in foisting, you know, Joe Biden on the nomination, and so essentially ran Hillary Clinton light. What I even think people, you know, I even think of him as kind of a JV version of Hillary. Like in some ways, Hillary Clinton was a much stronger candidate than Joe Biden is. So let's say they foist Joe Biden on the party. He wins the nomination. Then he loses to Donald Trump. And now they've lost back to back to this complete clown show. I don't think Russia would be enough to blame. You know, I assume that they would put a lot of blame on the left and say that, you know, the way that the campaign unfolded, it's meant that the supporters of Warren and Sanders didn't sufficiently migrate over to Biden. And therefore, that's the problem. But that doesn't really answer the question of how, you know, what their answer is if they can't beat this guy whose approval rating has never topped, 42%, then what good are they? Because they have always sold their compromises and their alliance with corporate America as pragmatic and essential to success. And so for rank-and-file Democratic primary voters who don't like those compromises, who don't like the alliance with corporate America, the only thing that they were going for was, okay, well, you're the adults. You know how to do this. You're the serious people. And so you're doing this to win. If they're not winning, then they don't have anything to offer.
And again, I'm joined in the studio by Ryan Grimm, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Intercept. He was previously the Washington Bureau Chief for The Huffington Post, where he led a team that was twice a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, winning once. And his latest book just out is We've Got People, From Jesse Jackson to AOC, The End of Big Money and the Rise of a Movement. So to my mind, a lot of people, Trump particularly, and then even on the left, they share this idea of a deep state. And the sad thing is that there really isn't a deep state. There, you know, I wish there was, because then they might be able to get rid of Trump. And the best that the deep state would offer is Robert Mueller, and look where that got us. You know, this constipated legalese that was so dense that nobody actually knows to this day that he actually wanted to indict Trump. So obviously we have a reality TV president who does government by stunt. And he was brought essentially to power by $6 billion worth of free advertising from the mainstream media, along with his facility as a reality TV star. He at least has that skill. He doesn't know how to govern, but he sure knows how to manipulate the media. Do you think that the very means by which he came to power could be used against him? In other words, reality TV, like the Watergate hearings? Because it seems to me that that's what he's most afraid of. He knows that those hearings with Michael Cohen were very damaging, and he doesn't want any more of that. So I did some homework when he first came on the political scene. I talked to a bunch of businessmen who had dealt with him, and they all say, without exception, that the guy is insane, that you spend 5 minutes with him, he's in his own world, all he does is talk about himself. He's just clinically insane in a narcissistic sense. So if you could get a camera inside the Oval Office for about 2 or 3 minutes and the American people could see who they're leader is, he'll be over in a heartbeat. How do you get to that point?
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, because when he first jumped into the office, jumped into the race, my great aunt was telling me that she had been at a dinner with him back in like the 1980s or so. And she told me she was convinced that he was on drugs. And I went back to her later to talk to her about that, you know, maybe 6 months after he'd been in the race. And she said, by the way, I completely take that back. I don't think that he was on drugs anymore. It turns out this is just how he is. this is the man himself. So I think that the person you're describing is more or less how he comports himself at his rallies and at his press conferences and in his public life. And so I think people don't actually have many illusions about who he is and his grip on reality. There are a certain number of people who like what he does. That, you know, they think he has the right enemies. He's punching the right people in the face. And there's, like you said, he understands how to manipulate mass media, and with that comes an understanding of kind of the public and how to play the public. And if you look at his tariff fight, I think it's a perfect example of it. In some ways, it's political genius. What he does is he goes out and proposes a policy that on its face is not smart, but is driven from a place that has diagnosed the problem accurately. You know, unfair trade deals, bad trade policy, undermining American working class. And because he's putting out something idiotic, both leaderships and both parties come out and criticize him for it. But now what the public sees is Trump is fighting for the workers and fighting for jobs and proposing tariffs, proposing to do something to try to make the situation better. And these people in Washington like Mitch McConnell are fighting him on it. And so it sets him up perfectly. And then at the last minute, he often backs down on them. And, you know, he hasn't backed down on all of them, and it's hurting a lot of people that he supports who support him. But it shows this knack for creating these situations where people who are casually following the situation would say, this guy's fighting for me.
Well, obviously, you're right, Ryan Grimm, in as much as the Access Hollywood tape hardly made a dent.
Mm-hmm.
But my sense is that, you know, there might be a Howard Beale moment, you know, where he just, you know, he's come close to kind of some meltdowns on camera. There's no adults left. He's purged everybody. There's just a bunch of sycophants. In fact, it's quite dangerous because he's the only people around him are Jared and Ivanka, Miller.
Barr.
And Barr probably now is in charge. And Mattis and McMaster and the other adults have gone. And Mnuchin.
Bolton, good Lord.
Yeah, and then, of course, he's got this toady of a chief of staff, Mulvaney, who's obviously not going to restrain him in any way. So it's pretty dangerous, really, when you think about it in that context. At least there were a few people around that if the guardrails are Ivanka and Jared, the merciful thing is that we've never had a foreign policy crisis. We haven't had a 9/11 or whatever other presidents have been faced with, and most presidents in their tenure do have a crisis on their hands. So do you think that one of the problems is that foreign policy doesn't really resonate too much with the average voter? But do you think at least the fact that this guy goes to meet with our closest ally and spends a day with the royal family and then at 1:30 in the morning tweeting insults to Bette Midler, do you think that gets people's attention? In other words, do you think the American people would like a little dignity in the head of state?
No, I think if they did, you know, they would have not elected who they elected. You know, I think that what a lot of people like in their current head of state is that he is undignified, and you know, he's the drain the swamp, the attacking everybody in power. Now there are absolutely a huge swath of people who are humiliated, you know, by the buffoon who's in the White House, and we should be careful not to overestimate his base, because it's common to hear people say, well, his base isn't going anywhere. You know, they strongly support him. And that's not actually true. If you look at the, you know, the numbers of, you know, his very strong approval ratings over his tenure, they have fallen in a significant fashion. That doesn't mean there aren't still more than 20% of people who stick by him, and Whitman might stick by him through anything. But the numbers that were in the high 30s or the low 30s are not there anymore.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the work that you've done. And you mentioned Barr being a significant player, and there was a fairly substantial piece in the New York Times recently suggesting that he really is, since he's got a tenure there and he's got some pretty strong background, that he is the adult now in the room. And my sense, I mean, there have been some rumors that Barr wants to be on the Supreme Court, but he is very close friends with Leonard Leo, the Federal Society guy, who, as far as we can tell, if he's not Opus Dei, which is a secretive organization at any rate, they don't publish their membership list, he's certainly as close as you get to Opus Dei. And I think that—
Well, we'd be lucky in some ways if he did get another appointment and wasted it on Barr, who's over 40 years old.
Right.
You know, he's going around looking for Federalist Society members who are not even out of law school yet. Like, that seems to be their move. So,
right. But the reason I bring it up is that you've done some work on how Kavanaugh got on the court and how the Democrats dropped the ball. And it is astounding to think that Dianne Feinstein couldn't bother to drive from San Francisco to Palo Alto to meet with Blasey Ford, who ended up being a very powerful witness. And she wasted, what, weeks, months?
Right.
That could have been used, because the press, the minute that Blasey Ford came public, and I think the leak came from Feinstein's own staff, who got frustrated with her.
Not exactly.
Well, tell me how the leak happened.
Right. So I was the first to report that, and I give some of the details in the book. One of the dynamics on the committee that contributed to a controversy being created, which then contributed to me learning about that there was a controversy, was that Kamala Harris was actually pressing Dianne Feinstein to share the letter that she had gotten with other members of the committee, not necessarily telling her that you need to publicize this, but you need to share it with us at least so that we can all collectively weigh in on what the best way forward is. But this was much further along in the process. You know, Feinstein for weeks had kept it secret and had her staff working directly with Blasey Ford and effectively talked Blasey Ford out of coming forward. You know, when Blasey Ford first reached out to Anna Eshoo, who was a member of Congress, she said, please keep this, you know, letter confidential until we've had a chance to speak, which is quite a different thing than saying, I don't want to come forward. You know, she had told her friends that she was planning on going public and her life was going to change. She reached out to the Washington Post tip line and communicated with the Washington Post, and she reached out both to Anna Eshoo, and then Eshoo shared the letter with Feinstein, and she talked with Feinstein's staff. So these are not the actions of somebody who's desperately trying to remain anonymous. You know, she understood what she was doing and the consequences that she would face and wanted to do it anyway. Dianne Feinstein and her staff, you know, convinced Blasey Ford both through their inability to slow Kavanaugh down, but also directly telling her, look, the story is too old. You know, this is high school. People aren't going to care. And also, according to Ronan Farrow and Jane Mayer's reporting, they told Blasey Ford that they wanted to keep the questions legal in scope rather than personal. Feinstein has since denied that she had said that, but that's my understanding as well. And so as Blasey Ford saw that the Democrats weren't really fighting, and as the ranking member on the committee was telling her, let's not go forward with this, then she did decide at that point to say, okay, I want to remain anonymous. And to me, a big tell was Feinstein's office asked Blasey Ford to put in writing that she had agreed to stay anonymous. Why would that letter be important or necessary?
Right.
And to me, and as Feinstein came under criticism for withholding this information, she then brandished this letter about and said, look, Blasey Ford herself asked me
Which is not
tricky.
True.
This, well, it eventually was true because right. Blasey Ford made a new calculation that, okay, Democrats aren't going to fight.
Right.
And yeah, well. And the ranking member is telling me that mm-hmm. there's no point in going forward with this.
Right.
So if these are the things I'm being told, right. then why am I going to turn my life upside down for no reason
right.
if he's going to get confirmed anyway?
Right, but the fact remains that had Feinstein not sat on this letter,
right.
if the press had learned about it earlier, they could have spent at least a month
right.
digging. And we recall that every day more and more information mm-hmm. was coming out. It wasn't so much a question of whether Blasey Ford, you know, was back in high school. Sure, but it led the press to start digging, mm-hmm. and they found out more about his tenure at law school and as
right.
an undergraduate.
And they did a disservice to her as well. In the way that it appeared, you know, he'd gone through his entire confirmation process and was mm-hmm. headed towards this final vote, and it appeared like Democrats were springing this in the last moment
exactly.
and strategically
yeah.
as if they
that's
had.
That's what Lindsey Graham
right, right.
Highlighted. Yeah.
Everybody was saying that this was an
ambush,
an ambush, a hit
right.
job, when in fact they planned on never releasing it, but by holding it until the very end and then having it leak out. They made it look much more political than it actually was. Blasey Ford tried to reach out to the press before he was even nominated, when he was only on the short list. So mm-hmm. it was not a political move that she mm-hmm. was making, but the way that they did it made it easy to frame it as that.
Well, let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back returning in a minute and continue our conversation with Ryan Grimm.
Outside the passion millions, put them into power. Expect a little more back for their taxes. Like school books, betting, hospitals, and peace in our bloody time. All they get is old men grinding.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And we're continuing the conversation here in the studio with Ryan Grimm, who's the D.C. Bureau Chief for The Intercept. He was previously the Washington Bureau Chief of The Huffington Post, where he led a team that was twice a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, winning once. And his latest book just out is We've Got People, from Jesse Jackson to AOC, The End of Big Money and the Rise of Our Movement. So having established that in many ways the Democrats are their own worst enemies, or that Democratic timidity and excessive centrism is the kiss of death, and whether that will be translated in this election season, one only hopes it's not true, but it does feel like that Joe Biden's shelf life is pretty much over, but if they could run a cocker spaniel and beat this guy, I'd vote for it. So that's not the issue so much. But let's talk about another Democrat that is leading the counter-revolution. I mean, the most counter-revolutionary Democrat that you've identified, of course, is Rahm Emanuel. Mm-hmm. And I think you can make the case, as your book does, that, you know, that he stymied Obama's mm-hmm. presidency in those early days. Because it's interesting that, just in the historical context, whenever the Democrats get the trifecta, the House and the Senate and the executive branch, they get nothing done. It happened with Clinton. From mm-hmm. 92 to 94, he basically got nothing done. And the same with Obama. Mm-hmm. And when you get all three branches, the expectation is you ought to be able right. to get something done. And it seems in many ways that Emanuel stymied the possibilities. You know, there's so many things that Obama could have accomplished, many of which have to do with protecting labor. They had an opportunity mm-hmm. to protect labor, which they didn't. And labor, of course, has been completely assaulted by the Republican right and by the Supreme Court. So he's one of them. And there's also this other guy, this congressman in New Jersey, Josh Gottheimer. How significant are they? Because all the energy and all the ink and newspapers and all the TV cameras are flocking to AOC.
It depends. You know, they are quite influential as a mass group. If you take all of the kind of what are called the New Democrat coalition in the House, you have enough to stymie any progressive legislation. Even if you only took the Blue Dog coalition, which had been destroyed after 2010, when the Tea Party wave wiped out a lot of Blue Dogs, you know, they've really come back to the point where they have enough of a block that they can swing it. And Blue Dogs and New Dems, Blues and News as they're called in the House, have something that progressives don't, and that's a willingness to vote no. Progressives, you know, during, and I write about this in the book, during the Affordable Care Act debate, more than 50 members of the Progressive Caucus wrote a letter to Nancy Pelosi saying that if there isn't a robust public option in the final health care passage, then you can forget about their votes. They're walking. And this was one of the first attempts by, you know, left members in Congress to use real power, to make a real threat, to try to extract compromises. And they were driven at the time by bloggers who had gotten a list of people who had not made this commitment and pressured them back at home. And of course, as we know, when it finally came up for a vote, they all voted for it, and it did not have a public option in it. The threats are much more credible coming from the New Dems and the Blue Dogs because they're quite less excited about the prospect of a universal health care bill. Like, even if it's not quite universal, the Affordable Care Act was a big advance, you know, a huge expansion of Medicaid, $1 trillion in subsidies for people to get coverage. And so for a progressive, they look at that and they're like, well, we tried hard, we lost, but this is better than this makes the world better than what we had before. Whereas Blue Dogs and New Democrats, they don't really like the Affordable Care Act that much to begin with. So they're quite willing to take it down over abortion or over, you know, whatever else they're fighting for. And so as a result, they wind up winning in negotiations. And so since then, progressives have been trying to think, what can we do differently? And one of the conclusions was that the numbers were too big. You know, paradoxically, nobody believed that all 50 plus of these people were going to actually, you know, vote this bill down. And so nobody believes any of them would. And they turned out to be right. But Ocasio-Cortez herself had floated the idea of a sub-caucus of just a handful of diehards who are actually willing to make a move like this. And so if you have five and they're a credible five and you know you need 218 votes and you only have 217 or 16, you need those five and you know that they will take it down, now you're going to talk to them and see what you can give them without losing other votes. But how to make that threat a credible one is a huge question. How to get the social base to support that kind of risky approach is also a huge question. Because like you said, so much of the Democratic DNA is just bound up in timidity.
So we started out talking about your books in terms of the phenomenon now of small dollar donations, which to some extent Bernie Sanders stimulated. And, you know, I know personally that anybody who shares my political beliefs are unelectable. I see this as a very conservative country, and I lived in Europe for a number of years, in the UK and France, etc., and where everybody was a socialist. All your friends were socialists. And in fact, it got so boring that I became quite conservative. And then I moved to this country, and everybody seemed to be so right-wing. I couldn't believe how right-wing it is. And then, of course, out of fairness now, I've gravitated, swung the pendulum. I've come back to the left. It's almost like a duty. So with that caveat in mind, do you think there is a move to the left, or is it just wishful thinking on our part?
I mean, if you objectively compare the median platform that was run on by a Democratic recruit from the DCCC in 2006 to the platform today, you'll see a huge shift. So
but is that going to work with the broader electorate?
Most of those won. So like, yeah, the Democrats took the House in 2018, you know, flipped 42 seats, elected some 60 plus three or so new members to the House of Representatives. And of those, yes, many of them were recruited by the DCCC, and many of them have business ties or, you know, are of questionable progressive timber. But all of them, almost all of them, their platform was much more progressive than the platform of the average Democrat in 2006. You know, nobody was calling for a public option, a public health care option back in 2006. Now the public option is kind of the compromise, you know, sellout position. You're either for Medicare for all or you're for some type of Medicare buy-in. And so Medicare buy-in used to be the kind of left edge of where House Democrats were. And, you know, the conversation around the Green New Deal has changed things a lot as well. Now we're much closer to the point where, you know, action has to be taken. So in some ways that the urgency has compressed the energy around climate change. But at the same time, there's just a lot more willingness to talk about it and confront it in a serious way. So I do think that the party has moved as a reaction to the country moving and the base of the party moving, but you still do have the same precise individuals, you know, making a lot of the calls at the senior levels who are quite nervous about anything that smacks of liberalism.
And where do you think the public is, though? Because the more they know about social democracy, the simple formula that you vote representatives in who have become stewards of your tax dollars. And of course, we couldn't be further from that. And there's been an erosion. You know, arguably, maybe we had a social democracy between 1944 and 1977. But it's been, you know, they're even going after what pillars are left, which are Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. But all of those programs are popular once people recognize them, even though they've been demonized. So is there a shift underway at that level in terms of consciousness? Because there's a lot of reporting suggests that the young people no longer see socialism, the S word, as being a dirty word. And look at Germany, for example, one of the most successful economies, certainly the most successful export economy. They have, on all of the major corporations, they have members of unions on their boards. And clearly the biggest change that took place in this country was the demonization of government itself, starting with Reagan, who under Reagan, Americans stopped saving, they stopped getting a pension, they stopped getting a raise. Reagan enabled credit to give people the illusion that their standard of living was raising. So ever since then, we've had a more indentured society. So if you look at it all, and particularly the sense that now you can even be concerned about whether or not we're still a democracy and we're becoming a plutocracy. Right. So all of those things would, to me, make a very powerful argument about, you know, the need for a collective agency to really take back democracy in the most fundamental sense.
Yeah, and I wrote about the Carter years a lot, I cover the Carter years in the book, and they're interesting for a lot of reasons. But one of them is that, you know, Carter's been so valorized in his post-presidency, and for good reasons, that people forget what a conservative and bad president he was for the 4 years that he was in there. And this was a time when, you know, capitalism was in a bit of a crisis, you know, massive surpluses, so much power residing in the upper echelons of capital, and also union power getting to, you know, new extraordinary heights in ways that were producing huge raises, you know, year over year over year. And so you had the clash of these two powerful interests as the kind of global economy was deciding what was next in store for it. Carter became a champion of deregulation. And it's easy to knock deregulation, but it accurately identified a problem that people had with the economy. The airlines were heavily regulated, and all it did was create inefficient monopolies, corporate monopolies, that nobody liked flying on and that were probably dangerous. And so the solution that they came up with was, well, deregulate this and let the market take over. But at that same time, if the Democrats had gotten their act together and elected a progressive in 76 in the nomination instead of Carter, you know, the kind of thing you're talking about could have been instituted. Labor reform with, you know, reforming the governance structure of corporations so that, you know, there's worker and stakeholder input at the board level. and that maybe the quarterly, you know, for-profit shareholder model doesn't become the kind of default. Like there's, it's not written in stone that that has to be the way that companies are organized. That's just what the United States decided under Carter and Reagan.
Yeah, and both Carter and Clinton were from right-to-work anti-union southern states. So just in closing, Ryan Grimm, bring us back to, I guess, the essential optimism in your new book. Mm-hmm. We've got people from Jesse Jackson to AOC, the end of big money, and the rise of a movement.
Right. I mean, we do have people. And so that is a line that is borrowed from Ocasio-Cortez's viral campaign ad, where she said, you know, the race between me and Joe Crowley is a race of money against people. You know, they've got money, we've got people. And I thought that that was such a useful kind of distillation of all of the reporting that I've done over the last 12 years or so on this conflict. And it can be deeply depressing, the amount of money that the insurgent movement is up against, the number of structural obstacles that lay in its way. But I like the reminder that there are also people, and that people are, you know, tend to be on the side of change when you have a system running the way that we do. And so the end of big money is aspirational. I'm not describing any precise moment, but if you look at where we are from a historical perspective, and if you see that the big money donors have effectively lost the Trump administration, you know, the Trump relies on small dollars and free media hits. You know, he has empowered his con artist allies to go out and raise as much big money as they can, but there's no sense that those big donors have control over Trump. You know, he's probably uncontrollable to begin with. So then these big donors are left with the Democratic Party. Big money's left with the Dems. And the guy that they're sending out to do a battle to the death, you know, this final fight for control of the party is Joe Biden. You know, imagine that you're the donor class, and this is the horse that you have to ride into this climactic battle.
Right, and he's from the banking credit card state of Delaware. It is famous for LLCs.
No, a C-list politician who failed miserably in 2008, failed miserably in 1988, and this is what they've been able to rustle up for this climactic challenge, whereas the left does seem to have the energy, both in the ideas, the plans that Warren is putting out, and the people that Bernie Sanders has behind him.
Well, Ryan Grimm, I'm very grateful for you joining us here in the studio today, and I thank you.
Glad I could be here.
And again, I've been speaking with Ryan Grimm, who's the D.C. Bureau Chief for The Intercept. He was previously the Washington Bureau Chief for The Huffington Post, where he led a team that was twice a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, winning once. And his latest book just out is We've Got People, From Jesse Jackson to AOC, The End of Big Money and the Rise of a Movement. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.